Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Walter Block about the free market, anarcho-capitalism, and everything else that has to do with these related topics, of course. And we have yet then to come to this very point that we kind of talked about in the beginning, really, but how we can stop, you know, the bad guys from exploiting us. There's so many kind of subsections to this as well, and I have a couple of things I want to run by you in terms of this later as well. But let's get to that point now then and clear that off the table, Walter.
The reason I think that police can do a better job under a free market society than they do at present, because in both cases, they're asked, they're tasked with the job of stopping murderers and rapists and thieves and other bad guys. But they're also, at present, trying to stop victimless crimes. They're trying to stop prostitutes who are just, when they engage in consenting adult behavior, should be left alone. They try to stop people from putting drugs into their bodies, and I don't see why they have to do that. Didn't we learn anything from the prohibition of alcohol, where we had vast criminal gangs in Mexico? The gangs fight the army on roughly equal basis. They're so powerful. Uruguay, I think, is just legalizing drugs, and thank God for Colorado and Washington, which are legalizing marijuana.
Yeah.
So the police, in addition to doing what they should be doing, stopping bad guys, are stopping innocent people who are guilty of victimless crimes, namely no crimes at all, gambling, drugs, sex, pornography, whatever it is. So if they stop doing that, they would have more time to stop the real bad guys. Look, the case in point is I live, my office at Loyola University in New Orleans is right across the street from Audubon Park. And Audubon Park is a lovely park, and on a Sunday afternoon, it's crowded and it's very safe, but it's getting dark now. It's almost 6 o'clock here, and soon it'll be midnight and at 2 in the morning. And sensible people don't walk in that park at 2 in the morning because they can get mugged very easily. Whereas take the case of Disney World or Disneyland. That's also a private park, or rather that's also a park, but it's private. And if you act obstreperously, you'll be surrounded by a bunch of mice and ducks and geese and other people all packing heat. And they'll say to you, sir, come with me quietly, or come with me not quietly, but you're coming with me. And they have cameras all over the place. It's very, very safe, because if a murder or a rape occurs in Disney World, the people won't go to Disney World, and they'll lose profits, and they'd go broke if that happens. So they make every effort they can to make it safe for their customers. Whereas if a mugging takes place on the streets of New Orleans or in the parks of New Orleans, who in a position to stop that loses money? The parks commissioner? No. The mayor? No. Nobody. So, of course, they have less incentive to stop it. So what we should do is privatize the streets and the roads and the parks and the museums and everything else. If it moves, privatize it. If it doesn't move, privatize it. And then the parks and the streets would be safer. There are private streets in Disney World that are very, very safe, and there are public streets everywhere that are not so safe. So in addition to the police, private police having able to focus on just bad things and not stopping victimless crimes, they would stop creating crimes. It's sort of like welfare creating poverty, even though it's ostensibly deal with poverty, to ameliorate poverty. It creates it. Well, it's the same thing here. When you prohibit drugs, what you do is you raise the price of drugs, because now the costs are not just providing them for the market, but eluding the police and fighting the police, and that costs more. It's very expensive, which brings in the criminal element. You just legalize drugs like we legalized alcohol, and there's no more crime over wine or beer or alcohol in the United States or Canada. I'm not sure about the Swedish situation. But it would be the same thing with drugs. When they legalize all drugs, not just marijuana, the criminals will have to go into other pursuits, and we'll have Pfizer and Squibb and other pharmaceutical companies providing drugs, just like we have Shenley and Four Roses providing alcohol without any problems. So in these two ways, we would be much safer in our streets if we got rid of public police and had private police, or if we kept the public police, but just got rid of these victimless crime laws so that the police could focus on what they're supposed to focus on, and they wouldn't be creating crime as they go. And they're never going to win the drug war. Why aren't they going to win the drug war? Because every time they win a battle, they lose the war. Look, suppose that the Narcotics Bureau interdicts a shipment and they burn the shipment of say cocaine, just to pick a drug out of the hat. What happens to the price of cocaine when there's less cocaine because they burned the whole bunch? And sometimes they don't burn it, but they go into business for themselves, which is a whole other problem. Well, the price goes up.
Right.
Well, if the price goes up, the profits go up, and if the profits go up, more people are led into that business.
Yep.
So it's sort of like me fighting Mike Tyson at the height of his powers. And, you know, Mike Tyson and I don't belong in the same ring. But if every time I touch him, he gets hurt, and every time he knocks me down, I come up stronger, I'm going to beat him.
Yeah.
There was a Greek mythology. There were two gods fighting like this, and one was the son of the Gaia, the Earth Mother. Mm-hmm. And every time the stronger guy dropped this god to the floor, she put them up harder or stronger. Well, every time the cops win, quote unquote, against the drug gang, they strengthen them. They don't weaken them. They might weaken that gang, but they strengthen gangs in general, because the prices go up, and when the prices go up, the profits go up. So they're not going to win this. Why do we have it? Well, some people are economically illiterate. They think that the best way to stop this is with more power. Other people think that it's a very bad thing, and I agree with them. Now, I'm not advocating that people use marijuana and cocaine and heroin. I think it's a very bad thing. I don't use that myself. I wouldn't want my children to use it. I think it's very, very bad. Maybe, possibly, marijuana is good if you have glaucoma or eye problems or cancer patients use that. I'm not really an expert. I'm not a medical expert. I don't know. But the point is, I'm not advocating the use of these things. I'm advocating the legalization of these things, which is a very, very different kettle of fish.
Now, let's talk about the bad guy then, from the point of view of people who don't, let's say, on the one-to-one level, the rape or murder. Of course, that's very bad enough in itself. But let's talk about those who manage to, let's say, influence government to the point that they end up, you know, taking over them pretty much by lobbying and having them work for their favor. They ascend high up in the corporate world. They at that stage, government pretty much protects the corrupt corporations and it helps to create monopolies that squeezes out all the competition. They become kind of untouchables pretty much in that regard. But what do you think about, let's say, information and reputation as quality control for ensuring that we work with, you know, quote unquote, good people who do good work? I mean, today, for example, with the internet, it's tremendously easy to search, to find reviews, to see what kind of quality work businesses really do and all that stuff. I mean, under a free market, we would have more competition and consequently more options. In this case, I think quality control could be handled by, you know, the customers and the consumer instead of like third party organizations that run the risk of getting, you know, corrupt or bought out or something like that. But with the, how do you see this with all the technology that we have available today then, especially with the internet, how could that work to support a free market and in kind of ensuring that we also get, you know, the good stuff, if you will?
Well, I don't think we have to rely on present technology. Even 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years ago, the market could have solved that, although I think you're right in pointing out that it can better solve it nowadays. Even in those days, we had Consumer Reports and Kosher Foods, which are private certification agencies, Consumer Reports, and all sorts of other reports on various quality of products and drugs and stuff. There are three theories here. One is on government regulation. One is the most unsophisticated and false, namely that government regulation is necessary for the quality of food and drugs and stuff like that. We need the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. We need the Agriculture Department. We need all these people to solve things. Then you get George Stigler, a Nobel Prize winner from Chicago, University of Chicago, who had this thing called capture theory. And what he meant by capture theory, and I think that's what you were getting at, is let's look at it from the point of view of a regulator. You're a low-class regulator, and you're regulating some pharmaceutical company. and you do a good job, and you're nice to the pharmaceutical company. And then what they do is they hire you. You leave government service at a low salary, relatively low salary, and you go work for this pharmaceutical company for a couple of years. And then you move back into the government at a much higher position. And then you move back to the pharmaceutical company in a much higher position, vice president or president. Namely, you got the same people who are regulators and regulatees. Namely, yeah. The regulatees are, in effect, capturing the regulators. So the company that's being regulated, let's say Boeing airplane is being regulated by the government in charge of air safety. And the people, if you look at their career, some of them have worked in the government before, now working for Boeing and vice versa.
Yeah.
So you have this capture theory. That's the second theory. And that's a lot more sensible than government is the good guy.
Yeah.
The I think even a more sophisticated theory is that I came across was from Murray Rothbard and a guy named Gabriel Kolko, who's a Marxist. There's an interesting story behind him. And what they say is that the initial food and drug and railroad regulation and all of these regulatory bureaus, they came from the it wasn't that they came from consumers who asked the government to step in and help them, or from politicians who were helping consumers. Rather, the initiative for these things came from industry. Why? Because the meatpacking companies and the pharmaceutical companies and other large companies were losing market share to smaller competitors. And they tried and tried to outcompete these small guys, but these small guys were more efficient. And then they came up with this magnificent way of stopping them, which is sort of the way the union stopped the scabs with the minimum wage, parallel there. And what this way was is having a Food and Drug Administration. And who are you going to stock it with? Well, people from industry. Who yeah. better? They know how to work pharmaceuticals or meatpacking or whatever it is. And they would regulate in such a way to defend the big corporations and to hurt the smaller competing ones. One way was very ostensible and explicit. They would just rule against the small guy. They wouldn't allow them to merge or whatever it was. And the other way was more insidious. Namely, they would have paperwork, lots and lots of paperwork. And the large companies had economies of scale in filling out paperwork that the small companies didn't have. They already had a staff that could do this, and there were economies of scale. If you have to fill out 100 pages, it's not 10 times as much as 10 pages. It's a little less. So they had a competitive advantage, not in satisfying consumers, but in satisfying government regulations, of which there are many, many. So that would be the third and the most sophisticated analysis of this government regulation of business. Let me give you an example. There was this case of thalidomide. And thalidomide was a morning sickness drug that was approved by the West German at the time FDA and not disapproved by the American FDA. And it was a very good drug for morning sickness because women in the first trimester of their pregnancy cough up their guts, and thalidomide helped them. But when the babies were born, there were birth defects in 1 or 2% of the cases, or a small number of cases, but they were horrendous. Kids were born without arms or with forearms or two heads or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Just horrible birth defects, and it was traced to thalidomide. Well, now, if you had a private certification industry composed of, I don't know, the Harvard Medical School, the Consumer Reports, the automobile rating agencies, all sorts of rating agencies like Fitch, Standard & Poor, and Moody's for stocks and bonds, and one of them approved this of thalidomide, what would happen to that one? Well, they'd go broke.
Yeah.
Namely, if you really mess up in a gigantic, horrendous way, people lose, would you call it reputation, that they lose their confidence in you. So we would be much better served by an industry composed of, 5, 10, 15 rating agencies for pharmaceuticals or food and drugs or whatever it is. And if some of them do a good job, they'll get more customers. And if those do a bad job, they'll lose customers or go broke. Rather, now what we do is we put all of our eggs in one basket.
Yeah, yeah.
And we say, okay, FDA, you do it. You're the monopoly of it. And when they screw up, that's it. They don't go broke. Nobody says, well, the FDA should be closed down. So that's a type one error, namely approving of a bad drug. But then what happened is they were burned by this. I mean, who wants to be responsible for growth defects? So now what the FDA does is instead of approving drugs quickly, it makes you go through all sorts of hoops. It makes you take 10 years to get a new drug on the market. And it costs millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars to get a new drug on the market. And now you got people dying not from a type 1 error of approving of a bad drug, but by a type 2 error not approving of a good drug.
Right.
And the FDA does a little of each. They kill us in both ways. God bless them. The obvious answer to this is to privatize that sort of a thing. Now, one of the most horrendous things that the FDA does is when you're in the last stages of terminal cancer and you've been given 3 weeks by the doctors to live, which means anywhere from 1 to 6 weeks, and you want to try some experimental drug that has not yet been approved by the FDA, guess what the FDA says? They say, no, you can't do it.
Yeah, that's
those
right.
Bastards. And I use that word purposefully.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I don't apologize for it.
No.
That's horrible. Here's a guy who's dying. Body is wasting away. He's got terminal cancer and apricot pits or God knows what. Somebody says it might work and the goddamn FDA won't let him throw the dice.
Yeah.
That's horrible. Now, if the FDA said, okay, look, we advise against it because we don't have any proof that it works. Well, that would be less vicious than what they now do. But what they now do is they don't let people in terminal illnesses even try to save themselves. I mean, there are things that are more despicable than that, maybe dropping an atom bomb on civilians, but it's hard to think of anything much more despicable than that. That's really, really disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the best natural, you know, herb, you know, things that I use, compounds, all that has like not evaluated by the FDA on it. So, I you know, you end up going around that process, you know, down the road anyway. I'm not saying everyone should do this or whatever, but in my case, you know, I have a more of a holistic point of view. I look at, you know, things are organic, et cetera, things like that, right? So, but in this case, you have to be the one who's there to support them financially through your taxes. But then at the end of the day, you still, as a person, have to go around all that to try to avoid what they recommend pretty much because of their track record in the past. You know what I mean? It's like, wow, it's gone really far, hasn't it?
Well, I think we ought to arrest you. I mean, you know, you're violating all sorts of laws. You're a holistic person. That's despicable on your part. I mean, how dare you put asunder what the FDA says? They're God, aren't they? Who the hell do you think you are thinking for yourself? You have a lot of nerve.
Exactly, exactly. And that's really what it's about in a way, isn't it? It's a following suit and everything else. I mean, and FDA is just one example, of course. I mean, we can look at the same that goes for like safe limits concerning things like Wi-Fi, for example. It's industry run, all these approval. And then yet at the same time, what seems to be happening is that people want more of the same as more and more kind of, you know, scared they get of all these things that occur as well. So they want to give more power to those who already have proven themselves not to actually work when it comes to these things. So we have to look somewhere else than these government institutions to provide this for us, correct?
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of people went to public school and public school miseducates you. And I think there are also sociobiological reasons why people are so, you know, ignorant and invincibly ignorant. This is, you know, a big challenge. How do you stop this, given that people, look, when they have a survey about the minimum wage, most people support the minimum wage. When they have a plebiscite about should we get rid of the FDA, nobody's favoring that. Ron Paul is trying to get rid of the Fed. We haven't talked about the Fed, but there's a very similar kind of a thing.
Sure.
They came in 1913. Now it's 100 years later. And if you compare what happened 100 years before and after 1913, you can see that they've ruined the economy. And yet Ron Paul says, let's get rid of the Fed. And people say, what? The guy must be nuts.
Yeah.
And it's good and sufficient reason for that. The economics profession, at least the macro money people, are very much in favor of the Fed. And I'll give you one guess why. And the answer is the Fed stuffs money down their throats.
Yeah, exactly.
It gives them publications in prestigious journals. It's the way to get the promotion in academia. They have all these conferences, very high-level conferences, very luxurious ones. No wonder the economics profession is in favor of this. And when a journalist asks an economist, well, what do you think of getting rid of the FDA? They say, what are you, crazy? So Ron Paul is dismissed as an old coot or a loony or something like that, and yet he's speaking truth to power, and he didn't win the election. He came close. He almost beat Romney, and if he would have beat Romney, I think he would have had a good chance to beat Obama, because he could have outlefted him on drugs and sex, and he could have outrighted him on war, and outrighted him on economics. He's much more economically free than Romney.
Indeed. I do agree with that. We'll see if we get the time here to talk a little bit more about the Fed later. But there are a couple other things I want to ask you about. How would, let's say, something like natural resources handled in a free market? And again, we can extend that conversation into, you know, anarcho-capitalism as well, if you so please. But how would we prevent, let's say, you know, pillaging and depletion of natural sources, you know, free market environmentalism? There are, you know, kind of some of these ideas out there. Is this anything you've looked into, Walter?
Oh, yes. I've got a book or two on that. And I teach a course on environmental economics. And I go over all sorts of things, global warming and species extinction and, I don't know, pollution and just on and on. I spend the whole semester on that. In the New York Times today, it was a thing. Let me see if I have it right here.
Yeah.
Here it's on page A4 of today's New York Times, January 7th, and it says, "Destruction of ivory by China wins praise." This is page A4, and there's a whole picture of a bunch of ivory confiscated, and now they're going to burn it in an effort to curb elephant poaching.
Huh.
This is just horrible. Look, why are elephants going extinct? The reason elephants are going extinct is because they're not owned. They're not privately owned. Let's get off elephants for a second. Let's get onto cows and buffalo. Mm-hmm. I like this example better because cows and buffalo sort of look alike, at least to the layman. They're about the same size. They give milk. They have horns. If you crash into one of them, you're in trouble. And yet the cow never went within a million miles of extinction, and the buffalo almost did. You had this lousy movie, Dances with Wolves, a very good movie if you suspend all judgment, but all economic judgment, but a horrible movie if you keep your wits about you, because it was saying that the reason that the buffalo was extinct was because of white man's greed or something like that.
Right, right.
Summarize it.
Which is very wrong, of course.
Oh, absolutely wrong. Yeah. Look, the reason that the buffalo almost went extinct is people were not allowed to own buffalo. And the reason the cow never went extinct is because people were allowed to own cows, private property. They could brand them before there was barbed wire. And when there was barbed wire, they could fence them in. And, you know, have all these lefty hippie songs, "Don't Fence Me In" and home on the Range with a buffalo and somebody else roam. Deer and buffalo, somebody's roaming around. Mm. Well, roaming is no good. What we got to do is barnyardize these guys and then save them from extinction. Look, if you kill a cow, your own cow, the costs to you of killing your cow today is that you don't have that cow tomorrow. So it's a pretty hefty price, and you're only going to kill that cow when the time is right. But if you kill that buffalo, or rather, if you don't kill the buffalo, what's the cost? What's the cost to you of killing the buffalo? Is it a buffalo tomorrow? No, tomorrow the buffalo will be over in the next county. So it's very cheap for you to kill the buffalo, and you might kill the buffalo just for the tongue or just for the skin or whatever it is. So the reason people take care of their cows is because if they don't kill them today, they have them tomorrow. The reason they don't take care of their buffalo is because if they don't kill them, they're not going to have them tomorrow anyway. So they might as well kill them. So all you have to do is privatize the buffalo, allow people to fence the buffalo in. Okay, the buffalo have to roam, so you have to have big farms. What the heck? But still, then there'd be no in danger of buffaloes. Nowadays, sometimes people are now allowed to own buffalo, and the whole issue of buffalo going extinct is just off the table. It was the same thing with the crocodile or the alligator. I always get those guys mixed up. At one time, they were going extinct, and then they were allowed to, people were allowed to own them for the skin or the meat or whatever it is. They feed nutria to them, and they have alligator or crocodile farms, and the crocodile is safe. Well, a buffalo, rather an elephant or a rhino, is just a buffalo or a cow with a funny-looking nose or a funny-looking horn. It's the same thing. They're just a little bit bigger. And if we would allow people to own those elephants and rhinos, they would be just as safe as cows. The reason they get poached and killed just for their tusks is because of non-ownership. Look, if I own a buffalo, an elephant farm, and that concept shouldn't be sound as awkward as it does, but it sounds very awkward now. But if I owned an elephant farm, would I would use the elephant for the skin, the tusks, the meat, whatever. And also for shooting. People could hunt them and pay me for shooting them. Would I allow people to shoot even a pregnant elephant? Yeah, but the price would be very, very high. On the other hand, to shoot an old bull elephant past the time of reproduction, or an old female elephant past the time of reproduction, would cost a lot less. Namely, the industry would be more sensible, it would be more well-regulated, more economical, and there would be no danger of extinction. But nowadays, what they'll do is they'll go and kill a pregnant elephant and take the tusks and run away in a helicopter or in a truck. So the answer is, and then they have CITES, C-I-T-E-S, Convention on International Trade in Elephant or Extinct Species or something like that, C-I-T-E-S, I forget the exact words. And they say we shouldn't have any trade. Well, if you're not going to have any trade, then it's not going to be sensible for you to own these creatures. Look, suppose we said we couldn't have any trade in cows. You can't sell a cow. Well, then the cows would all go extinct. The reason the cows and the chickens and the pigs are doing pretty well is people can profit off them and they have an incentive to protect them. The reason that the rhino and the elephant aren't doing so well and are on the verge of extinction is because of a lack of private property rights. So yes, free market environmentalism says that the cure to all environmental problems without exception is markets, private property, privatization.
Well, there is this thing about basically people as well who own their own land, you know, how the difference in how they take care of it and want to, you know, keep it for what they want to do, as opposed to, you know, if government owns it or something like that. It's just how it works and operates. It's just if there's neglect associated with it, then you're going to get all those things where people don't care about it, they don't care to keep it up. And the same would go for animals, I guess, in that regard. And I mean, and this would be in the context of, let's say, you know, the elephant today is like, that's in itself is like tourism industry, right? There's things there that people would do to take well care of these animals because it's something that they could, you know, turn into a tourist trap, right? So that there's all these things behind that as well.
Yes. Botswana is one of the countries in Africa that has the most move toward private property. They're not really good. Well, they're not excellent, but they're pretty good. Give them a B-. And the elephant herds there are surviving and expanding. Whereas in other countries where they burn ivory, Kenya and I think some other countries, I'm not sure, there the elephant herds are disappearing. So you're quite right. If you own it, you take care of it. If you don't own it, you don't take care of it. And this applies to elephants or land or bicycles or anything.
Yeah, yeah. Now, okay, let's go back. I don't think we really touched upon that, but let's say resources, natural resources, mines and, you know, iron ore, even gold and things like that. What's the view there, Walter?
Well, there was this bet between Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich. Julian Simon was one of our boys, a free market environmentalist, and Paul Ehrlich is a winner of the MacArthur Genius Award for lefties. And they had a bet, are we running out of resources?
Right.
And they decided to base it on the relative prices of four or five resources. And Julian Simon won the bet. And Paul Ehrlich still never shut up about his doomsday Malthusian nonsense. And these lefty environmentalists are riding high. You see, there are some people, in my view, that just like running other people's lives. They don't want to live and let live. They want to run other people's lives. And for a while, they were doing pretty well with communism. Communism was a great way to run other people's lives. And then around 1991, East Germany fell apart. The Soviet Union fell apart. And they had no vehicle with which to run amok over our lives. And they had to hitch their wagon to a different horse, and the horse was environmentalism. So I call these people watermelons.
Yeah,
they are green on the outside, but they're red on the inside. They're just a bunch of old commies in new dress or new drag or whatever, green, the outside of a watermelon, and they're trying to run our lives. And one of the things that they say is we're running out of resources. Look, we're never going to run out of any resources. That's nonsense. Because every time we start running out of a resource, what happens? The price rises.
Yeah.
And when the price rises, people use less of it and look for more of it and more substitutes for it. So we're never going to run out of resources, with the possible exception of a few spaceships that we sent off to Mars or Pluto or wherever we sent them. Those resources we've run out of. But that's, you know, an infinitesimally small amount of resources. The rest of it's still here on the Earth. So we're not running out of resources. There's no peak oil. We're not running out of oil. They subsidize all sorts of, solar power and wind power. Although I love this thing with the windmills, because the windmills kill birds. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
The lefties love the birds, or boids, as we used to call them in Brooklyn. And they love wind power, and yet the wind power is smacking up the birds.
And it looks horrible, by the way. My God, it destroys the environmental landscape. I mean, I've seen some of these farms, that, you know, driving in Sweden. It looks like something alien. I can't put my finger on it, but these tripod kind of designs to them and everything, it completely destroys and drags all of your attention towards those things as opposed to the forest or the land itself. You know, it's amazing how that goes.
Well, at least we're not going to have them in Cape Cod, because the Kennedys and all those rich people around Cape Cod didn't like the aesthetics of it.
Right.
So we had the NIMBY, not in my backyard. Look, I'm not really against, the windmills. I'm against the subsidization of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And if they weren't subsidized, they wouldn't exist, because it costs much more to get electricity that way, or solar power or water power or wind power or all these other powers, than good old nuclear power or oil or gas or coal or whatever. Maybe we should bring in a little bit of egalitarianism in here. We talked about egalitarianism before. Why should we push our thumb on the balance scale? Let all resources compete equally. Let wind and water and solar compete with nuclear power and coal and gas and whatever. Oh, my favorite bumper sticker on nuclear power is, how many people died at Three Mile Island? Zero. How many people died at Chappaquiddick? That was Teddy Kennedy killed Rosemary Kopechne. I forget her full name.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the bumper sticker. But the point is that they had some problems in Japan, and they had some problems in Chernobyl. But by and large, nuclear power is very, very safe.
That seems to be much more about the location as well, in terms of these waters where they put these plants, by the way, where they know that there are tsunamis and everything else. And it seems like, again, that whole process was very irresponsible, you know, in that regard. And they knew that it wasn't the best place to put them on. Yet it happened, and they did it. And now, like, the whole, you know, that tremendous problems from the fallout there. I hate even thinking about it, you know?
Well, on the other hand, the government put its thumb here as well. They subsidized nuclear power by limiting the liability of nuclear companies. I forget the name of the act in the United States that, in effect, subsidized them. So the government is busy subsidizing and taxing and pushing and pulling and have industrial policy. They've learned nothing from the Soviet Union, which was industrial policy par excellence. They just don't want to allow markets to be free, because there are various people who are subsidizing them, who are bribing them. What is it? 7 out of 10 of the richest counties in the United States are all clustered around Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing? I mean,
yeah.
Why? Well, because Washington, D.C. Taxes money from the whole country and then gives back some of it, and the rest stays in Washington. What is it? They say what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. What happens in Washington stays in Washington.
Right.
What happens in Washington is a lot of money creation and money tax grabbing, and a lot of it stays there and enriches those people. And they have the power of the press, you know, NBC, ABC, CBS, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the area from Boston down to Washington, the corridor there. Those are the ruling class people that run this country. And here we have some sort of overlap with our friends on the left, Chomsky, for example, in criticizing what we call crony capitalism or corporate capitalism. And the Pope recently made some comments about how evil capitalism is. Well, I agree with the Pope. That kind of capitalism is evil. It really shouldn't even be called capitalism. It's really fascism.
Yeah.
This crony capitalism and corporate welfare. This system is rotten to the core. And the lefties sort of agree with us libertarians on this and have done great work. I mentioned one of the workers when we were talking about railroads and regulation. I forget his name now. Mm-hmm. It begins with a K, right at the tip of my tongue. So here you have an overlap of lefties and free market economists. And we're all opposed to what's going on, but they somehow think that this is the essence of capitalism. They don't realize that it's not true. All through South America and Latin America, when they think of capitalism, they think of large corporations exploiting the poor. And if that were capitalism, I'd be against it too. But they don't distinguish between that and laissez-faire capitalism. The Pope is from Argentina. He's a member of the Jesuit order, which is a very beholden to this idea that markets are very bad. And
yeah.
This is just a crying shame that they don't better distinguish between fascism and laissez-faire capitalism.
Is that a part of the plan, if you will? Because absolutely, I mean, I've noticed this too. I've seen it in movies that comes out and everything as well. There's, you have these the arch, you know, capitalist evil person at the end. You know, they're meeting this person and they're talking about, like, you know, this is capitalism and blah blah blah, and they've, you know, exhibited this extraordinary evil behavior. It's like, it was one movie, Assault on Wall Street. There are a number of these that have been coming out now, and they all bunch everything together, and I can't just help to see that this is about, have you know, jumping on that opportunity in a political sense to bring down that ship once and for all, including what could be a free market, you know, capitalism, and bunch that together with crony capitalism and everything else as well, as a means to raise popularity for the flip side of the political spectrum. I can't view it anything different. What do you think about that, Walter?
Oh, I entirely agree with you that the powers that be, the major media, are pretty much singing from the same chorus about the evils of capitalism. This is a horrible situation. It's very hard. I mean, Ron Paul did yeoman work. Ayn Rand did great work in doing this. Mises, Rothbard, the Mises Institute, all of these people are trying to push the rock of Sisyphus up the hill and keeps on rolling down. Hayek used to say that every generation of us has to fight the same battles, and that's true. And I think we just have to tell the truth. What is it? Preach truth to power or something like that. We just have to do the best we can we're now doing in this interview. I think this interview will go out to dozens or hundreds of people. And
and
that's great.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be, you were talking about the internet and modern technology. Before the advent of the webs and the blogs and this and that and the other, the only main sources of information were, you know, the big three TV sets, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and the major Newsweek and Time Magazine and the Washington Post and New York Times and places like that. And there was no way that we could even be heard. Now, happily, we can be heard. This interview is one example of that. We are being heard. Ron Paul is doing great work with his TV station. Interviews of mine are all over the web. You Google me, Walter Block, and you'll find interviews of all sorts. So we can now communicate with each other, and the major media don't like that. They say, well, we're all on a different page. We don't communicate together. Oh, we still read the New York Times and barf at Krugman and people like that. But we are making great strides thanks to the democratization or the equalization of media ability. You know, the big websites still don't match the New York Times and CBS, but we're doing better than we used to.
Well, indeed, exactly. I have a couple of more points here I want to, you know, pass by before we wrap up for this time, but it's kind of a separate issue in one regard. But are you aware of Fabian socialism at all and the rise of that within the United States of slow incremental socialism as opposed to revolutionary socialism? And as an extension to that, I guess I'd like to ask you as well, where you think America would end up if indeed the move was made towards Fabian socialism, welfare state, and everything else. Would that crash the country pretty much? Would that just take her down?
Well, first of all, let me say you should never ask a professor at an American university if he's aware of Fabian socialism. There's nothing but Fabian socialism going on university campuses.
Yeah, I know.
There are many campuses where, like in New Orleans, there's one free market economist at all of Tulane, and they must have, I don't know, 1,000 professors or several hundred. Yeah. At LSU, there are zero. How do I know that? Because I give lectures there, and I ask the kids, are there any libertarian professors, and they say no, not one.
Yeah.
Loyola, we've got an amazing amount. We must have, I don't know, depending on how you count it, maybe 6, 8, or 10, which is gigantic for a relatively small school.
Why is that then, as on a side note?
Well, academia is a fully owned subsidiary of the left, just like the clergy is, and just like the newspaper, major media are.
Yeah.
These are the redoubts of the left. You get the Fox News every once in a while, and they're somewhat pretty good on economics, but they're horrible on foreign policy. And even on economics, they know better than they should be, although they're, you know, way better than MSNBC. But academia and the newspapers, the major newspapers, are just wholly owned subsidiaries of the left. And whenever a person such as myself talks about free markets, it's very hard to get tenure, very hard to get promoted. But things are getting better. I am an endowed chair professor at Loyola, so somehow I managed to sneak in here while they weren't looking.
Now, let me ask you a little bit about things like GMO. There are other kinds of technologies coming onto our world, I guess, for the lack of a better term, that have the capability of changing things radically. I mean, this is, some of it is on the scale of you know, nuclear weapon technology almost, and there are things that are in development now that are, you know, scary in that regard. And again, we come back to this issue of, all right, you know, regulation, how do we prevent people, blah, blah, blah. And then you come back to the same scenario again, but well, even if you hand over all that power to governments, they still don't do a good job, you know, on that. But let's just talk about like GMO for a little bit then. I mean, one company, let's say Monsanto, have deep ties with the government, have the ability to basically infect the biosphere with this one crop that would, you know, have Terminator seed technology within it. It would potentially have the capacity of taking out all the other crops if a scenario like that was, you know, run far enough and it went bad enough in that regard. That's why they do certain of those experiments way, way deep in the underground, for example, because they're so afraid of this, you know, getting out there in the biosphere. Some are being done on the surface, though, so it's not that that's, you know, safe or anything like that. But how would we approach those kinds of major global issues, I guess, under something of a free market system or even anarcho-capitalism? Is there a need there for a great body that has the influence of having its say, if you will, over governments? But again, then we are back in that same scenario again. Okay, then they'll run the risk of getting, you know, taken over and everything else, right? So what's your approach to this?
Well, I'm no expert on chemistry. I'm no expert on biology, so I don't know really the facts of it. You know, there's a joke about the Economist and a Summa can opener. There were three people marooned on a desert island, and they had cans of food, but no can opener. There was a physicist, a chemist, and an economist, and the physicist said, let's drop the cans of food on a rock of a certain hardness, and it'll open up, and we can eat the food. And the chemist said, well, I agree with that, but let's heat it up, and the can will open, and we'll have hot food. And they turned to the economist. He said, let's assume a can opener. Well, I really don't know about the facts of the Monsanto genetically modified foods. So I'll assume either that it's okay or that it's not okay. Let's assume both cases. Well, if it's okay, then that's an easy one. Then we shouldn't bug them. And if it's not okay, we should have an injunction against them. And a court, presumably a private court, should rule as to whether this is a clear and present danger. You know, suppose I'm building an atomic bomb in my basement right next to you. And well, if I do it in secret, there's nothing you can do. But if I do it, somehow I advertise it. Hey, I'm building an atomic bomb, which I take to be the worst case scenario of the Monsanto. Do you have a right to get an injunction? And I would say yes. If you go to court and say, look, Block is a crazy. He's building an atomic bomb in the middle of New Orleans or in the middle of South Carolina, and I want an injunction, namely a court order to get him to stop. Well, I think that's perfectly reasonable. Look, libertarianism doesn't have the answer to everything because a lot of these things depend upon the facts.
Sure.
Is this really a danger or not? And as a libertarian theorist, I have no real strong views as to whether it is or not. And this is why we have to have courts. And the courts are told, to uphold the libertarian axiom of non-aggression. And does this constitute a danger or not? It's for the courts to decide. And I think that's the way I would approach that.
Well, indeed, exactly. It's very much an issue by issue. And again, all the information and just weighing. I mean, at this stage also, though, we have so incredibly much information at our disposal, contradictions everywhere. And even in that process, while people are meddling and trying to figure it out, things, development-wise with technologies kind of run on, if you will. So there's that danger within it as well, before you even have the time to come to a conclusion about something. It's operation and in work. But you're right. It is an issue by issue. And it's something that, we have to continue asking about and using our brains and thinking about these things and really make sure that we do the best of the situation. Because I think, as one of the main points that you've emphasized as well, the flip side of what we're looking at here, though, if we don't assume personal responsibility, if we don't allow for these, individual choices to be made when it comes to economy and everything else, is a system that's going to lead down a, for the lack of a better term, totalitarianism. It'll be all about control and will be homogenization of everybody, equalization. And even if you are, fooled and think that that would be the good option, I think at the end of the day, Walter, that would prove to be a tremendously horrible world to be in, unfortunately, because it would be everything about control, and you wouldn't have the power to do anything individually with your life as you would want to do, right?
Yes, I certainly agree with you, and I think that's a good way to end this conversation.
Indeed.
We've been at it for an hour and a half, and I'm glad to let you have the last substantive word, because you've been a magnificent interviewer, and anytime you invite me, I'll be on again.
Thank you, Walter. Do you want to give us your websites again?
WalterBlock.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for time and perspective, Walter. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and you too.
We have some great shows coming up with Rick Falkvinge from the Pirate Party to talk about civil liberties, online privacy, and the Pirate Bay founder Svartholm Vaj was put in solitary confinement in Denmark recently. We have Dan Fogler, Richard Dewhurst, Ben Davidson, Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, and John King. Thank you to all our members. My thanks to the crew at Red Ice for all their hard work as well. We'll be back in just a couple of days. Until then, we say have a great weekend. Take care, everybody.